Anything I can get you before I go? He eyed her pleadingly and rolled his aching neck. My shoulders are tight. Midge didn't bite. Take an aspirin. He pouted. No back rub? She shook her head. Cosmopolitan says 2/3 of back rubs end in sex. Brinkerhoff looked indignant. Ours never do. Precisely, she winked. That's the problem. Midge! Night, Chad. She headed for the door. You're leaving? You know I'd stay, Midge said, pausing in the doorway. But I do have some pride. I just can't see playing second fiddle, particularly to a teenager. My wife's not a teenager, Brinkerhoff defended. She just acts like one. Midge gave him a surprised look. I wasn't talking about your wife. She batted her eyes innocently. I was talking about Carloman. She spoke the name with a thick Puerto Rican accent. Brinkerhoff's voice cracked slightly. Who? Carmen in food services? Brinkerhoff felt himself flush. Carmen Huerta was a 27-year-old pastry chef who worked in the NSA commissary. Brinkerhoff had enjoyed a number of presumably secret after-hours flings with her in the stockroom. She gave him a wicked wink. Remember, Chad, Big Brother knows all. Big Brother? Brinkerhoff gulped in disbelief. Big Brother watches the stockrooms, too? Big Brother, or Brother as Midge often called it, was a Centrex 333 that sat in a small closet-like space off the suite's central room. Brother was Midge's whole world. It received data from 148 closed-circuit video cameras, 399 electronic doors, 377 phone taps, and 212 freestanding bugs in the NSA complex. The directors of the NSA had learned the hard way that 26,000 employees were not only a great asset, but a great liability. Every major security breach in the NSA's history had come from within. It was Midge's job as internal security analyst to watch everything that went on within the walls of the NSA, including, apparently, the commissary stockroom. Brinkerhoff stood to defend himself, but Midge was already on her way out. Hands above the desk, she called over her shoulder. No funny stuff after I go. The walls have eyes. Brinkerhoff sat and listened to the sound of her heels fading down the corridor. At least he knew Midge would never tell. She was not without her weaknesses. Midge had indulged in a few indiscretions of her own, mostly wandering back rubs with Brinkerhoff. His thoughts turned back to Carmen. He pictured her lissome body, those dark thighs, that AM radio she played full blast, hot San Juan salsa. He smiled. Maybe I'll drop by for a snack when I'm done. He opened the first printout. Crypto. Production. Expenditure. His mood immediately lightened. Midge had given him a freebie. The crypto report was always a piece of cake. Technically, he was supposed to compile the whole thing, but the only figure the director ever asked for was the MCD, the mean cost per decryption. The MCD represented the estimated amount it cost Translator to break a single code. As long as the figure was below $1,000 per code, Fontaine didn't flinch. A grand a pop. Brinkerhoff chuckled. Our tax dollars at work. As he began plowing through the document and checking the daily MCDs, images of Carmen Huerta smearing herself with honey and confectioner's sugar began playing in his head. 30 seconds later, he was almost done. The crypto data was perfect, as always. But just before moving on to the next report, something caught his eye. At the bottom of the sheet, the last MCD was off, The figure was so large that it had carried over into the next column and made a mess of the page. Brinkerhoff stared at the figure in shock. 999,999,999, he gasped. $1 billion? The images of Carmen vanished. $1 billion code? Brinkerhoff sat there a minute, paralyzed. Then, in a burst of panic, he raced out into the hallway. Midge! Come back! Chapter 44. Phil Chartruckian stood fuming in the SysSec lab. Strathmore's words echoed in his head. Leave now. That's an order. He kicked the trash can and swore in the empty lab. Diagnostic my ass. Since when does the deputy director bypass Gauntlet's filters? The SysSecs were well paid to protect the computer systems at the NSA, and Chartruckian had learned that there were only two job requirements: be utterly brilliant and exhaustively paranoid. Hell, he cursed. This isn't paranoid. The fucking run monitor's reading 18 hours. It was a virus. Chartruckian could feel it. There was little doubt in his mind what was going on. Strathmore had made a mistake by bypassing Gauntlet's filters, and now he was trying to cover it up with some half-baked story about a diagnostic. Chartruckian wouldn't have been quite so edgy had Translator been the only concern, but it wasn't. Despite its appearance, the great decoding beast was by no means an island. Although the cryptographers believed Gauntlet was constructed for the sole purpose of protecting their code-breaking masterpiece, the SysSecs understood the truth. The Gauntlet filters served a much higher god, the NSA's main databank. The history behind the databank's construction had always fascinated Chartruckian. Despite the efforts of the Department of Defense to keep the Internet to themselves in the late 1970s, it was too useful a tool not to attract the public sector. Eventually, universities pried their way on. Shortly after that came the commercial servers. The floodgates opened, and the public poured in. By the early 90s, the government's once secure Internet was a congested wasteland of public email and cyber porn. Following a number of unpublicized yet highly damaging computer infiltrations at the Office of Naval Intelligence, it became increasingly clear that government secrets were no longer safe on computers connected to the burgeoning Internet. The President, in conjunction with the Department of Defense, passed a classified decree that would fund a new, totally secure government network to replace the tainted Internet and function as a link between U.S. intelligence agencies. To prevent further computer pilfering of government secrets, all sensitive data was relocated to one highly secure location, the newly constructed NSA data bank, the Fort Knox of U.S. intelligence data. Literally millions of the country's most classified photos, tapes, documents, and videos were digitized and transferred to the immense storage facility, and then the hard copies were destroyed. The data bank was protected by a triple-layer power relay and a tiered digital backup system. It was also 214 feet underground to shield it from magnetic fields and possible explosions. Activities within the control room were designated Top Secret Umbra, the country's highest level of security. The secrets of the country had never been safer. This impregnable data bank now housed blueprints for advanced weaponry, witness protection lists, aliases of field agents, detailed analyses and proposals for covert operations. The list was endless. There would be no more black bag jobs damaging U.S. intelligence. Of course, the officers of the NSA realized that stored data had value only if it was accessible. The real coup of the data bank was not getting the classified data off the streets. It was making it accessible only to the correct people. All stored information had a security rating, and, depending on the level of secrecy, was accessible to government officials on a compartmentalized basis. A submarine commander could dial in and check the NSA's most recent satellite photos of Russian ports. but he would not have access to the plans for an anti-drug mission in South America. CIA analysts could access histories of known assassins, but could not access launch codes reserved for the president. CISSEX, of course, had no clearance for the information in the databank, but they were responsible for its safety. Like all large databanks, from insurance companies to universities, the NSA facility was constantly under attack by computer hackers trying to sneak a peek at the secrets waiting inside. But the NSA security programmers were the best in the world. No one had ever come close to infiltrating the NSA databank, and the NSA had no reason to think anybody ever would. Inside the CISSEX lab, Chartrakian broke into a sweat trying to decide whether to leave. Trouble in translator meant trouble in the databank, too. Strathmore's lack of concern was bewildering. Everyone knew that translator and the NSA main databank were inextricably linked. Each new code, once broken, was fired from crypto through 450 yards of fiber optic cable to the NSA databank for safekeeping. The sacred storage facility had limited points of entry, and translator was one of them. Gauntlet was supposed to be the impregnable threshold guardian, and Strathmore had bypassed it. Chartrakian could hear his own heart pounding. Translator's been stuck 18 hours. The thought of a computer virus entering Translator and then running wild in the basement of the NSA proved too much. "I've got to report this," he blurted aloud. In a situation like this, Chartrakian knew there was only one person to call. The NSA's senior CISSEC officer, the short-fused, 400-pound computer guru who had built Gauntlet. His nickname was Jabba. He was a demigod at the NSA, roaming the halls, putting out virtual fires, and cursing the feeble-mindedness of the inept and the ignorant. Chartrakian knew that as soon as Jabba heard Strathmore had bypassed Gauntlet's filters, all hell would break loose. "Too bad," he thought. "I've got a job to do." He grabbed the phone and dialed Jabba's 24-hour cellular. Chapter 45. David Becker wandered aimlessly down Avenida del Cid and tried to collect his thoughts. Muted shadows played on the cobblestones beneath his feet. The vodka was still with him. Nothing about his life seemed in focus at the moment. His mind drifted back to Susan, wondering if she'd gotten his phone message yet. Up ahead, a Seville transit bus screeched to a halt in front of a bus stop. Becker looked up. The bus's doors cranked open, but no one disembarked. The diesel engine roared back to life. But just as the bus was pulling out, three teenagers appeared out of a bar up the street and ran after it, yelling and waving. The engines wound down again, and the kids hurried to catch up. 30 yards behind them, Becker stared in utter incredulity. His vision was suddenly focused. But he knew what he was seeing was impossible. It was a one-in-a-million chance. "I'm hallucinating." But as the bus doors opened, the kids crowded around to board. Becker saw it again. This time he was certain. Clearly illuminated in the haze of the corner streetlight, he'd seen her. The passengers climbed on and the bus's engines revved up again. Becker suddenly found himself at a full sprint, the bizarre image fixed in his mind. Black lipstick, wild eyeshadow, and that hair, spiked straight up in three distinctive spires, red, white, and blue. As the bus started to move, Becker dashed up the street into a wake of carbon monoxide. "Espera!" he called, running after the bus. Becker's Cordovan loafers skimmed the pavement. His usual squash agility was not with him, though. He felt off balance. His brain was having trouble keeping track of his feet. He cursed the bartender and his jet lag. The bus was one of Seville's older diesels, and fortunately for Becker, first gear was a long, arduous climb. Becker felt the gap closing. He knew he had to reach the bus before it downshifted. The twin tailpipes choked out a cloud of thick smoke as the driver prepared to drop the bus into second gear. Becker strained.